The Morning Show. The Home Team. No, it's both. It's The Crossover with Sam Franco and Chris Brame.
Crossover, step back! That's a buzzer!
Right here on 960theref.com.
What's up, everybody? Sam Franco, Chris Brame back with another exciting edition of the Crossover Podcast right here on 960theref.com. And unfortunately, we don't have a whole lot of good to talk about. We will get to the Falcons and their trying to get to another NFC Championship, their second straight. And we'll get to that later in the podcast. But first and foremost, close but no cigar. The Dawgs get to the national championship, hold a lead over Alabama for the entire game, or at least tied with them for parts of the game. The only time Alabama led this game was right at the end when they won in overtime. And just a hard pill to swallow there, Brian.
Yeah, it seems like it's just it's a broken record for Georgia. Just in the Georgia finds the worst ways to lose games, and this is an all-time crusher. It's probably the worst loss that Georgia's ever experienced.
It's up
and,
there.
And it's not the feeling isn't going to go away until Georgia ultimately does taste that that glory and win another national championship. But you know, as we talked about, it's been 37 years, and now another season's going to come, and it's going to be 38 when we kick off the 2018 season. But I keep telling myself, I just wish that if that Alabama kicker had just made the field goal at the end of regulation, I don't think I'd feel as bad right now as I do, because I'd gotten to the acceptance part and started to feel like Bama was going to come back and win that game. And at that point that they were lining up for that field goal, I was like, boy, Georgia blew it and they're not going to win. But then all of a sudden you get to overtime and it's second down and 26 from the 41-yard line. And
I know,
thinking,
man,
like, my God, I mean, Georgia's going to win.
Yeah.
They're going to survive this and win after all.
I mean, Devin Bellamy gets that sack and you're sitting there, you're like, holy crap, this is going to happen. It's second and 26. Their field goal kicker can't make anything. Yeah, Georgia's going to win.
Yeah, and it's just, you know, how quickly it happened. It was just stunning and just it was a cruel finish to what still is and will always be one of the great seasons in Georgia football history. I mean, this year was an absolute blast. It's the most fun I've had talking about a college football season since we've been doing this job, and it was just cruel for it to end that that way. I'm telling you, it'd be much easier if the guy, just wish that kicker had made that field goal.
If
Bama was going to win anyway. I mean, ultimately, I just wish Georgia had hung on to the lead they hadn't won, but recognizing that through the course of that game, it just felt like things were shifting and that game was drifting toward Alabama being the superior side, and when they were just there with a chance to win it, I just wish they'd gone ahead and done it then instead of the way it did happen.
I'm right there with you because, you know, I'm with you. I had accepted it when they got into field goal range and Jalen Hurts comes in and takes that snap and runs it, you know, back around to get into the center of the field. I'm like, all right, you know, this is over. And then they miss it and you're like, oh yeah, now there's a chance. And it's just like you said, the most heartbreaking way to lose a game possible. So we'll get into the kind of the X's and O's, and of course we will second guess coaches that get paid way more money and are way more knowledgeable about this than we are. We'll get to that in a little bit. But first and foremost, in terms of where the proper blame should lie, I think it's bad character to blame officials for a loss most of the time, because a lot of the times, you know, these calls, you know, like, well, they even out, they go either way. But in this game, that didn't happen. Alabama, it seemed like, got every call that was one of those like 50-50s or whatever. And then Georgia got screwed over numerous times. You go to Tyler Simmons' block punt. And I keep hearing people tell me that, well, they jumped anyway, so it should have been a false start. First of all, I've watched that play probably 100 times now. The first person to jump was Simmons. And he jumped the snap perfectly. It was about as good of a jumping of a snap I've ever seen. And his jump caused two guys to move. So he was never in the neutral zone before the snap. So that blocked punt should have stood and should have let Georgia have very good field position. And then if that play alone stands, Georgia probably wins the game. But there was that. There was the missed face mask on DeAndre Swift. There was the missed pushing down of Jake Fromm after he got hit and taken down on that one play. And it just really seemed like In this case, the referees had way too much of an impact on the game, especially when apparently the head referee had already been, like, fired at one point for like, making too many mistakes.
From the Big Ten in 2002 after a Purdue-Wake Forest game, which is interesting because Jim Chaney would have been the offensive coordinator for Purdue in that game. But, yeah, and it's I guess it's mysterious that he was fired from the Big Ten in 2002. Obviously, he's been welcomed back there because he was officiating last year's Ohio State-Michigan game. And, yeah, and I'm like, I could come up with a half a dozen plays that that had nothing to do with the officials that I would love to have back from Georgia that would have made the difference in that game.
Of course.
But it's just, those were like some pretty, they seem like obvious mistakes.
Obvious mistakes and integral moments of the game.
Yeah. You see a face mask. There's an official standing right there when Fromm gets his head shoved. On their 4th and 4, their touchdown pass, they false started.
False start with an official standing right there.
Yeah, I'll actually, as big of a play as that blocked punt would have been, Georgia up 13-0, getting the ball in the field position they would have been. I can understand how they missed that. That one I get.
The snap jump was so incredibly good,
right,
that it fooled the official.
Plus Simmons kind of like.
He stutter steps.
Yeah.
It
just gives you a feeling like he was offsides and he stopped.
But he wasn't.
He wasn't, I know. He wasn't. But I understand that one doesn't just strike me as like, how did you miss that?
But them missing that was probably the
huge.
Biggest missed call.
But the other three were just seemed like they were just so obvious in plain sight.
Well, the 4th and 4, I mean, that also completely changes the game. If you're 4th and 4 and you go to 4th and 9, I don't know if you're going for it on 4th and 9.
Yeah, I mean,
I think
maybe
you might be kicking the field goal.
Sure, maybe they kick again, and then at the end of the game, they've got to try and score another touchdown instead of just settling in there for a game-winning field goal, which they missed anyway, unfortunately.
Right.
But I get, you know, just it's the question I keep having swirling in my mind is how there's this lead official who A, was fired once, but then B, was in charge of like a controversial ending last year with that 4th down spot for JT
Whether they
Barrett
got
at Ohio State
or
Michigan.
Not.
Yeah. And it really looks like Michigan got hooked in that game.
I think they did.
But anyway, I don't understand how you go from you're involved in this in a controversy like that to a year later then you're assigned to officiate the national championship game. I mean, what is the – and I know everyone defends officials all the time as they're human beings and they make mistakes, and I appreciate that. But, like, when coaches make mistakes, they get fired. When players make mistakes, they get benched. But with officials, it's just always like they're human. They're not going to get all the calls right.
Right.
But, I mean, what is the system in place to – I mean, at least demote these guys.
No, and look, again, I'm not sitting here saying the only reason Georgia lost was the officials, but if anything good comes out of this game, it needs to be a complete review from the NCAA of how officials are chosen for these games and how this works out. Because, look, I even talked about this with somebody. I'm like, well, once they determined that it was going to be two SEC teams in the national championship game, why couldn't they have just had an SEC officiating crew?
Well, I wouldn't have wanted that either, though.
Well, they're not great, but I'm saying they know the style of football and they know how the SEC runs and how those games go, much more than a Big Ten official would.
They know how it runs. It runs through Tuscaloosa, Alabama.
Maybe
I wouldn't have trusted SEC officials anymore. It's just when you realize that this is a lead official that's been involved in other controversial games, and here he is. I mean, how does he get to officiate that game? It's just I don't understand that process. And when you start Googling things about that game, I mean, I read a big story last year about in the Chicago Tribune in the aftermath of that Michigan-Ohio State game about Big Ten officiating and how lousy it's been. And of course, Jim Delaney defending it, but there's no real, like, no one knows. No one's gotten an answer as to why, like, I think everyone knows why he was fired in 2002.
But why was he rehired and then officiating this important of a game?
Yeah. Like, why was he rehired and how was the process that got him rehired? And then I know the answer to the question last year is like, well, why were they the crew at the Ohio State Michigan game? I'm like, well, because they were the highest rated crew in the Big Ten. But then, okay. But then they had this really controversial play. So, I mean, how does it turn around a year later? Then they're in this game, and then here he is. He's incorrectly signaling penalties. They're picking up flags for holds. And
what was
saying,
the one where he was like, first down, and it's like, it was third, and like, he only got 4 yards, and it was second and 10.
Yeah, that was it. They picked up that flag for a hold,
mm-hmm.
and then they went, all right, there's no penalty on the play, and then he went, the play resulted in a first down. And
I'm like, no,
it's currently 3rd and 7.
Yeah.
But it's like, you know, when little, again, I get, you know, they're human beings, but little things like that, you start to question the – you know, how competent the guy is.
Yeah, exactly. So just a hard pill to swallow for Dawg fans that the referees had that much of an impact on the game. But we'll go into some other reasons now why Georgia lost the game. And I think the first thing I want to point to here is, look, Nick Saban is the best coach that has ever coached in college football. I will go ahead and say that.
I agree with you.
He's past Bear Bryant.
100%.
He's the best coach that's ever coached in college football. And one thing that it took a lot of, you know, foresight, stones, whatever you want to call it, for him to do was to pull his quarterback and put in a quarterback that had never started a game.
Yeah, and, you know, I'd been reading prior to the Sugar Bowl that that he was taking first-team snaps, and there were reports that he was actually going to play in the Sugar Bowl. And
they didn't need him to.
No, yeah, I mean, Alabama just suffocated them. So, I mean, the thing about it, the making a deal out of Saban having the stones to make that decision at halftime, it appears they were actually preparing, though, and planning.
That's true.
For having him in there.
In case they needed to do it.
Yeah, and, you know, I think part of that was just realizing that, yeah, they were winning games with Hurts, but...
But the true potential of what they could do wasn't unlocked until, Tua Tagovailoa gets in there.
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty obvious. Their offense most of the year had just been sort of like this risk-averse, kind of like, let's just not make any mistakes, just lean on our defense and make sure we're not turning it over or anything like that. And, you know, you do think about with the recruiting powerhouse that Alabama is, it's like, why would Alabama need to have an offense where you've got a quarterback that's like, boy, they just don't do anything to hurt us?
Right.
Like,
wouldn't you be going for, like, you're getting five-star top-rated recruits at every other position. Why the hell wouldn't you want one at quarterback, too?
Right. And now he finally got one.
Right.
I mean,
exactly.
That's the thing. Like, now a decade deep into this reign of terror that they've had, now he's got his first real blue-chip quarterback.
No, he's got his first elite quarterback.
Yeah.
There's no question. I mean, you look at some of the guys they've had, John Parker Wilson, Greg McElroy, A.J. McCarron, Jake Coker. None of those guys, they were good game managers. None of them were elite quarterbacks. And now that, you know, Saban has one, it's definitely a scary proposition. So that's one thing. And looking at that, so Nick Saban had the foresight and you know, took some guts, I guess, or whatever, to make that call to go ahead to your freshman quarterback who never started a game. On the other side, I think a lot of Georgia fans are questioning why keep pounding the ball with Nick Chubb when he was clearly ineffective. He was not effective against Alabama. Sony Michel was finding gaps, finding space. Why didn't he get the ball more? And is that something you look on the coaching staff where Kirby just, you know, at that moment didn't have the foresight to make that call and to, you know, again, it's tough to bench a guy like Nick Chubb, but there was no space. He couldn't find the space to operate.
Yeah, no, that wasn't a Chubb game. That was Sony's game, and it should have been. And, you know, Chubb averaged less than 2 yards a carry, and Sony was at 7, and Chubb got 18 carries, and Sony got 14. And the first possession of the fourth quarter, Sony had a 13-yard, a 5-yard, and a 10-yard run, and then had one carry.
Yeah, that was like we barely ever saw him.
The rest of the game after that, and that would be – that's the one misstep, I think, from a, you know, a play-calling standpoint is – there wasn't enough Sony. And, I don't know. Maybe there's something revealing in the, you know, afterward when Kirby got choked up in the post-game press conference talking about how as they were about to run out of the field, Chubb came up to him and, you know, said something about, you know, I believe in you. I would do anything for you. And maybe then it's hard then as a coach to say, like, well, all of a sudden I'm not going to have you in the game in the fourth quarter. I mean, I don't know. I'm just
– No, and that's definitely something. I mean, you know, how can you tell a kid that has just, you know, poured his soul out to you like that, by the way, you're not getting it done tonight, so we're going to have to go with the other guy.
Right. And so, I mean, maybe that came into play and there was some loyalty there. And look, I mean, Chubb is one of the greatest running backs and players. We love him, but that was just not his game.
What I'm saying, I'm not using this to bash Nick Chubb.
No, that's the last thing
I'm doing.
That wasn't his game.
But
though,
factually, looking at the stats, he just wasn't effective. His style of running, right up the middle, you know, in between the tackles, that kind of thing, you can't do that against Alabama. But Sony Michel, the way he runs, his style, was proven effective.
You know, I think maybe at the early on in the fourth quarter, because Alabama, you know, Georgia ran a lot of plays in that first half.
So
if you start to think like maybe Bama's defense, it was kind of like the year before when they were on the field for so many plays against Clemson, that Georgia's style has been this year to finally get a team in the fourth quarter, and then you beat them to death with that running game.
The problem is Bama's defense wasn't tired in the fourth quarter. If you look at their body language, and I noticed this,
there were obviously
no hands on hips. There was none of that stuff.
Right. And so maybe, you know, that was the thing. Georgia, those first couple of possessions, thought maybe this is when we want to pound and wear them out with Chubb, and they're going to be gassed, and Chubb's going to be able to break them. But once it became clear that he wasn't, you had to go back to Sony. And I just, when Georgia went had the three and out and threw the two incomplete passes and that third down to Swift that was a little bit overthrown, and they were getting the ball back with 3.5 minutes.
If Swift catches that ball, I think we're – and it wasn't – let me rephrase that. If that ball is accurately thrown to Swift and he's able to catch it and get the first down, I don't know if we're talking about losing.
Then you're able to milk some more clock or whatever. But when we punted back to them, I just had a – that was when I – that was just the whole buildup there. Just felt like that game was swinging toward Alabama, and that was – you know, I felt like, all right, Jordan, they were going to come down. They were at least, they were going to put themselves in position for a field goal, and I had given up and basically accepted that Georgia was about to lose the game. And then, you know, that idiot kicker missed. He missed.
Before we kind of move on to what's next for the Dogs, I do have one more thing to talk about, and it's the play. And you know what I'm talking about, the play that beat Georgia on a 2nd and 26. They throw a 41-yard touchdown pass. How does that happen? I mean, is it miscommunication? Is it just a wrong play call? Like, Dominic Sanders, and again, I'm not bashing Dominic Sanders. He's been a hell of a Georgia player. Him coming back is a big reason Georgia was able to do so well this year. He got the interception in the Rose Bowl. So, you know, he's been a great dog. But in that instance, completely blew the coverage. And Malcolm Parrish had been getting victimized all night. You know, Alabama picked him to go after, and he definitely – was the right guy for them to pick, because DeAndre Baker, if you look at the other side, had a heck of a game. I mean,
it was the first turnover Bama had ever had in a title game was his interception.
Right. So, I mean, he played very well, but Parrish was struggling. And so in that instance, if you're a defensive coach, if you're Mel Tucker, you're Kirby Smart, and you know number 14 is struggling, how is there no help for him on that play?
Well, I mean, I think the play would have been designed to have the help there from the safety, and he, you know, Sanders didn't get over. I think when you look at – if you watch it too, you see Tagovailoa.
He looks off Sanders.
Yeah, I mean, he's looking kind of to the center and the right the whole time, and then it's like at the last second does he fire over there.
Flicks over.
Yeah, I mean, I think he – I mean, you got to maybe give him some credit, and it wasn't just all Sanders, like, completely botching the play. I think he did get duped there, and – Tagovailoa made a heck of a play and made a heck of a throw, and unfortunately, you know, Parrish got kind of beaten pretty fast there off the line too.
Yeah, and that's the thing. You can't just blame Sanders because Parrish didn't jam his receiver.
Yeah.
And that's what you got to do in that situation when you're running a cover two. So, unfortunately, not the ending that we all wanted. But looking forward to next season, I mean, Georgia's going to have a lot coming back. They will have a lot leaving. I mean, they're going to have to replace a lot on defense, but luckily in recruiting, they've done a very good job of filling some of those holes. And you know, you're going to have to replace, most likely, a Roquan Smith. I know that there's still maybe a tiny shred, sliver of hope that he may come back, but when you're as highly rated as him, it probably ain't going to happen. So you're most likely going to have to replace him. You're going to have to replace Bellamy. You're going to have to replace Carter. And, you know, Dominic Sanders, another guy you're going to have to replace. So there's a lot on defense. You got to fill the holes there. And, of course, Nick Chubb and Sony Michel. But you feel really good about Georgia's ability to do that in the backfield with James Cook coming in, with Zamir White coming in, although he is hurt right now. You've still got DeAndre Swift. And let's not forget Elijah Holyfield and Brian Herrien. You know, those guys will probably figure more into the offense with Nick Chubb and Sony Michel now gone. So you'll have that. You've got one of the best young quarterbacks in the country coming back. You know, and Jacob Eason probably not going to be there.
And Fields coming in.
And Justin Fields coming in as well. So, I mean there's a lot to be – and the offensive line. I mean, let's talk about that, because the way Georgia's cranking it out with these recruits, it looks like Georgia's offensive line is going to be quite all right going forward. And so I think next season, especially looking at the schedule that kind of breaks easily, your hardest game next year in terms of the travel, I mean, it's probably at LSU. I mean, just because – you know, you do play Florida and Jacksonville. You get Auburn at home. You get Tennessee at home. You get Vanderbilt at home. I know that's not a big deal, but I'm just saying usually you either back-to-back go to Nashville and Knoxville, or you get those at home. So all of that seems to be breaking pretty well for Georgia. Again, that only road test, the only real road test I see outside of Jacksonville, which, you know, Georgia probably should beat them again next year because the talent level on that team is still depleted. But – you know, that trip to LSU, that's really the only one I look at right now in terms of being a hard road trip. Auburn at home will be tough, but, you know, right now I think Georgia could be right back where they are at this point.
I think it's interesting that next year the schedule starts with two straight road games against the two teams that actually played Georgia the toughest this year,
conference,
though.
Right, yeah. South Carolina and Missouri.
Yeah, and, you know, that Missouri game is the first one. You talk about rebuilding the secondary, and, you know, hopefully DeAndre Baker comes back because he's going to be I think he'll be an all-SEC cornerback next season.
And with Derek Dooley now calling the plays.
But Drew
Missouri.
Locke is coming back there, too. Right. So, I mean, I think second game of the season, going to Columbia, Missouri, you know, and you know, needing to rebuild the defense a little bit is scary. And, you know, South Carolina's got Bentley there at quarterback.
Well, you're not
That's
scared of Austin Peay?
No, I'm going to give I'll give Georgia a pass on that one. But that Missouri game week two is one I think could be a tough one. Just seeing how things are going to be sorting out in that secondary, because while, you know, Baker will come back, hopefully Baker will be back and he'll be experienced there. But you have two new safeties, mm-hmm, and another guy on the other side there. I mean, you're looking at probably outside of Baker, you're going to have a secondary that's freshmen or sophomores.
Yeah, no, you're totally right. But hey, just because they're freshmen and sophomores doesn't mean that they can't be effective. So I think Georgia's got a very good shot to be right back where they were at this point, you know, this past season. I know that, you know, winning the East is always going to be your first and primary goal. And right now, it doesn't look like there's a whole lot of competition. I mean, like you said, Missouri might be a team to watch out for with that high-powered offense. South Carolina got better this season. Will they continue to improve and get better next year? Tennessee and Florida, to me, look like they're still a little ways away because, just like I said, they have to replace and rebuild the talent that was on those teams because they just didn't have it.
You know, the question with Florida is how fast Emory Jones becomes a good quarterback. And, I mean, I think they've struck gold finally. They've got Dan Mullen. He was a big-time recruit. So, and I'm completely convinced that he's going to be their starting quarterback. So by the time you get to play them in Jacksonville, you know, you're looking at 2 months deep into the season.
A guy who has some experience.
Yeah, I mean, he could be good to go there too. So I think the key for Florida maybe rebounding pretty fast in 1 year under Mullen will be how good Emory Jones turns out to be. I'm with you. I mean, Tennessee, I just don't see them being any good. I'm sorry. I don't think
that was a great hire.
I don't either. I mean, I think Pruitt might be able to do an okay job recruiting there.
I thought T. Martin, honestly, might have been a better hire just because of the fit for the program.
Yeah. I think Tennessee is really still in a pretty, pretty hot mess.
Me too. So, you know, I think – I'm going to go ahead and say this right now, way too early prediction. I think Georgia's right back in the SEC championship game next year. And then from there, you never know. If Georgia wins that game, then it's all out there in front of them.
Yeah, I do too. I mean, I think there's no reason that Georgia shouldn't be back in Atlanta at least next season.
All right, we will jump now on the Crossover Podcast to the Atlanta Falcons. They have a chance to make their second straight NFC championship game if they can beat the Philadelphia Eagles in Philadelphia this weekend. The Falcons, as I checked this morning, we're a 3-point favorite over Philadelphia. The first time ever a 6 seed has been favored over a 1 seed since they added a 6th seed, I believe, in 1978. So this is the first time that that's ever happened. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that Nick Foles is the quarterback for the Eagles. And here's the thing. This Falcons secondary, which is, I think, one of the better ones in the NFL when you consider – I know Robert Alford has his penalties, but he still makes some plays from time to time. Desmond Trufant, one of the top lockdown corners in the league. And your safeties, Ricardo Allen and Keanu Neal, have played very well this year. So I think that secondary going up against a quarterback in Nick Foles, who has had his struggles, you know, the Falcons could be in line for some interceptions in this game.
Yeah, and that's something that eluded Atlanta's defense for a lot of the season. What, they have like 6 all year?
Mm-hmm.
There weren't a lot of picks, but, you know, that's why I think maybe the Eagles will turn to Jay Ajayi, who, while he was playing for the mighty Miami Dolphins, ran for 130 yards against the Falcons in
that
terrible, terrible loss that Atlanta had during the regular season. So now he's in Philadelphia, and Atlanta's got to deal with him again all of a sudden in the playoffs. I liked Atlanta to win last week at the Rams. And
you know, I didn't. They completely, the way that game went, completely bucked all convention that I had.
And I know this is another one of those deals where it's like, here's the reigning MVP, Matt Ryan. This is a quarterback league and a quarterback time of the season and the postseason. And the Eagles are stuck with Nick Foles because of Carson Wentz's injury. But Foles isn't like completely inexperienced. I mean, they made the playoffs with him as a starting quarterback when Chip Kelly was there. This isn't like the Raiders last year that had a great year with Derek Carr and then he got hurt. And they ended up with Connor Cook making his first career start in the postseason. Atlanta's got a terrible history playing in Philadelphia.
Yes, they do.
I do not like Atlanta suddenly favored on the road in the playoffs, and I'd probably have to take the Eagles in the points on Saturday afternoon.
Yeah, I think I like Atlanta in this game, which is funny because we're going like we did last week, reversing how we feel about these games. Nick Foles, man, that's the only reason I can really give you right now that I like Atlanta in this game. I think Atlanta is going to have trouble because the Philadelphia defense is one of the best in the NFL. So this might be one of those head-on-head collision-type games where both teams are going to try to run the football, and we'll see who can do that. The Falcons defense, and the Falcons have completely flipped the script from being an offensive-led team to a defensive-led team here towards the end of the year. And that's what Dan Quinn wants. You know, he wants his team to have a fast, physical defense, and the defense really carrying the torch for the team. And their linebacking core is playing, and it's weird to include Vic Beasley in that because they've kind of made him that stand-up outside linebacker in the 4-3, even though he still gets down and rushes the passer a good bit.
Yeah, but Deion Jones is the stud.
Deion Jones and Devondre Campbell has played very well, too, and I think Duke Riley has a bright future as well.
They completely shut Todd Gurley down last
week. They
did, week.
And Deion Jones is turning into one of the best middle linebackers in the NFL, so... I like the Falcons on defense. I like the Eagles on defense. I think this could be a defensive struggle, and that might give Matt Ryan's experience over Nick Foles that little bit of the edge that the Falcons need. Plus, the Falcons have a huge weapon in Matt Bryant.
Yeah, that's true. And I know that's the biggest angle in it. It's the NFL. It's the playoffs. The Falcons have Matt Ryan, and the Eagles have Nick Foles starting at quarterback right now. But I just feel like it feels like a bit of an overreaction to have the Eagles at home, and then suddenly the Falcons are going up there and they're favored. And I think a lot of that has to do with the quarterback situation. It feels a little bit like a trap. You had the earlier in the week, Matt Ryan and Julio Jones both missed Jones has missed a couple of practices, and Matt Ryan missed that one for a personal matter there. But it's not a real strong lean. But I don't know. My hunch is that the Falcons are going to get beaten Saturday. I don't have a good feeling about them.
Well, we will see what ends up happening. Looking around the rest of the NFL playoff action coming up this weekend, you know, it's funny because you look at the, and I'll call it the Elite Eight that is left in the NFL playoffs. I think just based on the past few years, teams who would expect to be in this position, Falcons, Steelers, Patriots.
Yeah,
well, do you agree with that?
Yeah, but it's interesting. I mean, the Falcons were the only team they were the only repeat playoff team in the NFC this year.
Yeah, which is crazy. But that's the thing. I mean, just based on recent trends, those three teams I mentioned, you expect them to be there.
Sure.
Teams you don't expect based on recent trends: the Eagles, the Titans, the Jaguars, and the Saints. I mean, the Saints went three years in a row going 7-9.
Yeah.
So I mean, those teams are kind of new to this in terms of recent memory. So
the Jags are the
crazy.
The Jags are the big one. But, I mean, even with the Saints, I mean, they've got Drew Brees and Sean Payton. Those guys have won a Super Bowl before. The Jaguars are the one. I mean, what they went from 3-13 to 10-6 this year. Now they've won a playoff game. Mm-hmm. Now they got to play the Bills, but they did win it. That's another one. You know, they crushed Pittsburgh during the regular season.
30-9. Was it 5 or 6 picks for Big Ben?
It was a lot. But Bortles got picked a couple of times, too. I like Pittsburgh in that one to rally.
Yeah, I think in the playoffs, like, Pittsburgh is going to come correct.
Yeah, I don't trust Bortles.
No, and that's the thing. I trust every single other person on that team because they've drafted very well, and their defensive talent is unbelievable in terms of how young it is, and this could be a Jaguars defense that is around for the next few years in terms of being a very, very good one. But it's Blake Bortles.
Yeah, they're not going any. I mean, I don't know. Maybe they can beat Pittsburgh again like they did. But you really think Blake Bortles is walking into Foxborough in the NFC Championship game or the AFC Championship game and beating Tom Brady? I don't know if I can watch anymore because we just saw Alabama win the national championship.
Probably going to see the Patriots.
We're going to see the Patriots win the Super Bowl again.
Well, Steelers and Patriots is probably going to be the AFC championship game. Who will the Falcons be traveling to in the NFC championship game?
I think Minnesota. Who would you rather face, Minnesota or New Orleans?
Well, it's Minnesota because of the quarterback. I mean, it's Case Keenum. I mean, I think the Falcons played Minnesota very tight. It was not a great game from Atlanta, but I mean, the Vikings didn't look great in that Falcons game either. So.
Yeah, but the Falcons didn't score an offensive touchdown in that game.
Right, and that was at home. So definitely strange, but here's a hypothetical I'll throw out for you as we wrap up the podcast here. If the Falcons somehow make it back to the Super Bowl this year, and Dan Quinn has taken the Falcons to the Super Bowl 2 years in a row, is he already the best coach in team history?
Well, that's an interesting question.
I mean, I think it would have to be. I mean, this is the Falcons we're talking about here. Mike Smith didn't get him to a Super Bowl.
I mean, it would be better than Mike Smith, better than Jim Moore. I mean, the only one he's got competition with would be Dan Reeves.
And Dan Reeves, I still go to this day saying he should not have been fired when he was, because how could he have helped Michael Vick getting hurt?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, to go to back-to-back Super Bowls.
I mean, it'd be unbelievable. Coach Bro, Dan Quinn. And I see here, as we wrap up, this came, this is a tweet from ESPN UK. Says NFL VP of International, Mark Waller, says the Falcons and Bucks, who both have Super Bowl games being played at their stadiums in the future, will have London games in the future as part of their Super Bowl contracts. So the Falcons will be heading back to jolly old England in the near future.
But they better not be giving up a home game for that.
Who knows?
If you're a Falcons season ticket holder and they just built this stadium that leaks.
And you get to lose a game. Because
that leaks. And then all of a sudden you're only going to have seven games because you're going to London. Not to mention the taxpayers are the one that pay for it. And it leaks. It leaks.
The leak was overblown, okay?
Was it?
Yes, it was not.
Not according to Jeff, and he doesn't exaggerate anything.
That was sensationalism, okay? I was there. The leak was nowhere near what people were trying to say it was.
Okay. I mean, according to the Georgia Tailgate Show. I don't remember if it was Eric Zier or Hondo who it was, but they did make it sound like it was basically just gushing,
which is incorrect.
Okay,
but anyway, you know, as JD likes to say, the sun will rise again. You know, great times are coming for Georgia, but right now,
well, I think great times are here. This was a great season. I mean, let's not bury the lead on that. It really was. It hurts right now.
We called the dogs at Wrigley Field. Georgia went into Notre Dame and won. Georgia crushed all of their rivals this year, and Georgia won the freaking Rose Bowl.
Yeah,
it was a great season.
This was the best year Georgia's had since the early 80s, and this is a top five Georgia team in the history of the program.
Absolutely.
But that just kind of illustrates still, it might feel like it's the gap is narrowing, but just put this in perspective of how much work Georgia still has to do to get to where Alabama's been.
A team that has won 50% of the last 10 years of national championships, by the way.
That was probably Nick Saban, the sixth best team he's had at Alabama.
Yeah, no, I agree.
And
they were very injured.
Yeah.
I mean, they had a lot of players not playing in that game.
That was like the sixth best team Saban's had at Alabama against one of the five best Georgia teams of all time, and we still lost to him.
Tough pill to swallow, but the dogs will be back for sure, and we'll be back next week with another exciting episode of The Crossover right here on 960theref.com.
You've been listening to The Crossover with Sam Franco and Chris Brain on 960theref.com.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.